Welcome back to Elevate, where we are going to be talking today about ministry and education. This is a topic that you want to stay into the end because we have the education architect, Emmanuel Blanchard, here, who has more than two decades of experience in the education arena, as well as tons of ministerial experience, and is currently a senior pastor. So, Emmanuel, thank you so much for being here with me in studio in Atlanta.
Thank you so much, Janiqua, for having me. And it's a pleasure to be here in Atlanta. This is an awesome, awesome experience and chance to have a conversation with you.
Absolutely. Well, we had you on for the Fireside Chat in 2023, where we talked about education and anti-racism. Today, we're going to do something just a little different. Absolutely. We'll be digging into ministry. So I'm excited about that.
I am too. Can't wait. Let's get started.
All right, so let me read your bio, parts of it, because it's really long, so bear with me there. Emmanuel Blanchard is the senior pastor of the Francis Lewis Boulevard Church of God, which is actually in New York. He served as a youth pastor for over a decade, from competing in McDonald's Gospel Fest to community development projects. Emmanuel's socio-evangelical mission was already clear. For almost 20 years, Emmanuel has taught in both urban and suburban schools settings in New York. Additionally, he has taught a number of graduate-level university courses. Emmanuel analyzes latent, passive, intentional, and/or unintentional structures within educational spaces that simultaneously empower some while imprisoning others. I love that. Likewise, Emmanuel develops educational strategies that foster empowerment, diversity, creativity, accountability, and empathy. And then I want to read this part here. By the time he was a teenager, Emmanuel had already worked with the Columbia University Gospel Choir, incredible, New York University's All-University Gospel Choir, and scored on off-Broadway musicals. His musical work has been featured in NBC, CW, Pix 11, MSG Varsity, and a number of other media outlets. Emmanuel resides in New York. In his free time, he continues to write and produce music for various artists and is also the proud uncle of six amazing human beings. I love that.
Thank you so
Emmanuel,
much.
I love it. It shows all your sides. Your background is in ministry, it's in education. Yeah. Before we actually started recording, we got to talk a little bit about what that means. But I think for many people who may not know the correlation between ministry and education, could you start off by telling us a little bit about that?
No, absolutely. I think it's fascinating that we're talking about public education. And many of us have gone through the public education system. But we don't know that much about the history of education. So it's fascinating. We go through the system, but we don't know that much about the system in which we go through.
Right.
And public education in this country is relatively young. It's about over 100 years old.
Wow.
And prior to that, many schools were actually church-based schools.
Wow.
So there was a strong correlation in this country between churches and people going through getting very basic educations from a church setting.
Sure.
And so it's one of these ideas of, in terms of understanding the relationship between faith and religion, it's one of the reasons why we often see that many people who work in schools actually tend to have somewhat of a faith history.
Right.
Because in reality, the work of a minister and the work of an educator, it's about empowering and bettering people. So there's like
that.
A lot of overlap between the two. And that's why people will say that working in ministry is a vocation. But that's the same language we use to talk about education as well. It's vocational because, in part, you're working to improve the lives of individuals.
Wow. I mean, a lot of people don't know this information. You talked about public school education being relatively young in this country.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, prior to that, what did our education system comprise of? What did it look like?
Oh. You're going to make me go off now. One of the reasons why public education today struggles so much is because it is relatively new.
Sure.
And it also wasn't meant for it to be a universal thing.
Wow.
For the better part of the history of this country, education was something that was afforded to the most elite of those who are in this country.
Wow.
When you talk about institutions such as Harvard, or you talk about institutions such as Yale or Columbia, these are institutions that predate the founding of the country. You know, so for example, Harvard was founded in the 1600s. Mm-hmm. Columbia was founded in 1754. The country gets its origin in 1776.
That's right.
So the schools that the people who attended these universities were private institutions. They were never set up for your regular Joe Schmo to attend. They were never set up for every single person to go to.
Wow.
That idea of everyone deserves an education doesn't really start appearing until the late 1800s, the early 1900s.
Wow.
So what existed before were schools that were very, very select. And they were very, they discriminated. They were very intentional as to who could attend. Trust me, you and I would not have been invited to the party.
Never been at the table.
And I think that's one of the things that's really fascinating when people have conversations about public education or education in general. To even begin the conversation, let's make the history of education clear. It's relatively new, and very few people had access to it. But it's also interesting that very few people actually know the history of education in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just thinking about 100 years was not that long ago. You know, we're just talking about a few generations down. And so it makes a lot of sense why we see so much struggle in public education, especially versus independent schools and Christian-based schools, who we know their kids' outcomes tends to be a lot higher than our public school students.
Absolutely.
And so I'm wondering what has caused that shift? And in education from public, well, from private or from faith to public, in your opinion?
I think one of the reasons why they struggle so much is that these schools, many of the schools that originate, these independent schools, so for example, I'm like Exeter Academy, for example, or Andover Academy. These are probably schools that many people have never heard of. These were schools that were created alongside the same time as these elite schools were created, these elite colleges were created. And the reason why is because they were feeder schools. They are feeder schools to these top-end schools. Many of us have never heard of them. And the reason why is because they're not located in our backyards. They're not located in our neighborhoods. You have to actually be part of that elite class to actually gain access to these schools. Some of these schools, some of these high schools, and these are independent high schools, cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 per year.
Absolutely,
The curriculum, the grounds.
Yeah.
Like, these are places that have campuses that put, you know, like, lots of places to shame.
Absolutely.
And so when you ask this question, what creates these disparate, these totally different worlds?
Sure.
Is that those worlds were molded at the same time as the elite colleges and universities. They were set up as a clear pipeline.
Wow.
You go from your Exeters to your Harvards.
Wow.
But our neighborhood schools are 150 years, sometimes 200 years.
Sure.
Behind the histories of those Exeter schools, those Andover schools. So we're playing catch up.
Absolutely.
The funding is entirely different as well, too.
Sure.
So when you talk about the struggle, and that's the other part, too, is like, I think a lot of the power brokers, a lot of the people who shape public school education, a lot of the people, for example, parents, are not aware that this is actually another option.
Sure.
But it also is what shapes policies.
Absolutely.
And so we're fighting a different kind of fight, but we're not even aware of what's taking place over here. And that's what's disconcerting.
No, I mean, this is so good. My mind is firing off in so many different ways. And I often tell this story, and I hope people that have heard it probably 20 times don't stone me for it. but I'm going to tell it anyway.
Yeah.
So, of course, I'm a mom, a single mother. My daughter is in the sixth grade, Genesis, and her entire life she's attended private schools. When I was looking for middle schools for her in Atlanta, Georgia, of course I started looking at independent schools, and I was looking at those Westminsters and, you know, those top schools. And when I went through the doors and went on the campus, I was exposed to a new world.
Yep.
It was like Aladdin. It was a it was a whole new world. Yeah. I could not believe my eyes.
Yeah.
And While I was really, you know, excited for the opportunity for my daughter, my heart broke because I thought about all the students that don't have this opportunity and probably never will, you know?
Yeah.
And so it makes so much sense when you talk about being 200 years behind.
Yes.
There, how do you compete with that? You know, when you have had grounded, you've had proven curriculum over years, connections, access, networks.
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, there's always this inside joke that our presidents go to what two schools?
Yeah, Harvard.
Harvard and Columbia, yeah. Right? Yeah. Those are typically the schools that they go to. And I am a Columbia grad, as you are. But, I mean, I'm just saying, those are our Ivy League schools when most of our kids may never have access to that.
I think that's the big challenge is that, you know, one of the things that really saddens me in public education is that people fight and they don't realize they're fighting the wrong fight.
Mm, that's good.
You know, we're fighting. I'm not fighting for this, but there are those who are fighting to ban books.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not fighting for helping kids get better literacy skills.
That's good.
You know, we're fighting to not teach certain history.
Right.
When, in fact, by deciding not to teach history, you're actually equipping kids poorly for a changing world, a world that's constantly changing.
Right.
And so I think this is one of the reasons why when we talk about the relationship between ministry and education, for me, it's about social justice.
That's good.
This is all about social justice. Mm. You know, as you mentioned, I'm a proud Columbia alum. Mm. But I realized, whoa, when I got there, my first semester there, these kids who came from those elite schools were prepared entirely differently than I was.
Absolutely.
And it's then that I started to realize, oh my gosh, this is not just an education issue.
Right.
This is an economic crisis.
Absolutely.
This is a social justice crisis.
Right.
And the reason why I'm so passionate about this work, the reason why this is folded into my ministry is because there are so many forces that can confuse people. There are so many forces that can distract people. We live in a world where people are so distracted that they don't even understand that although you're sending your child to school for 12 years, you might be sending your child to a permanent disempowerment.
That's right.
Because you've been so distracted.
Wow.
And what that creates is not perpetual or generational wealth. Mm. It might create generational poverty. It might create generational enslavement.
Wow.
It might create generational imprisonment. Mm. And it's because we're so distracted. It's because we're so unaware.
Yeah.
And so for me, education isn't just about the luxury of reading books. It's about, there's a reason why, listen, what I've learned as someone who loves history is that if someone does not want you, if a higher authority or power does not want you to have something, if they've created laws that say we're going to outlaw you from being able to do this thing, there must be some sort of power and transformational power within this thing.
Wow.
There's a reason why people were often outlawed from learning how to read, from learning how to do arithmetic, from going to school. There's a reason why it was outlawed.
Absolutely. You know, this is so incredible. I'm thinking about the ministry aspect of this, which is, you know, what today's conversation is about and that intersection, or really education being something, I guess we could say, was founded on ministry or founded by ministry or by the church.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm wondering from your viewpoint, what has happened where we have sort of taken a position where we have disconnected ourselves from that world of education?
It's a great question. And it's actually one of the biggest challenges that I have or that I see in terms of marrying the relationship between ministry and education.
Yeah.
You know, Brown versus Board of Education, which is the landmark Supreme Court case in 1954 that leads to desegregation of schools. A lot of the civil rights achievements take place because of faith leaders.
That's so good.
You know, whether you're talking about Martin Luther King, whether you're talking about Malcolm X, if we go to India and we talk about Mohammed Gandhi, these are faith leaders. They're not just civil rights leaders, but these are people who are driven through their faith by principles.
Yeah.
Dr. King, the reason why he was able to build a diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-generational civil rights movement is because he challenged individuals with respect to their faith.
Yes.
if you believe X,
yeah,
and you truly believe you are a good Christian, how can you do things that support racist attitudes? Yeah. How can you support racist structures? How can you support racist institutions? Yeah. If you truly value your faith, now you have to actually move to where I'm trying to move.
Yeah.
I think, though, that once we get past April 4th, 1968, that's the day that Dr. King was assassinated, many spirits were broken.
Absolutely.
And I think that we're still dealing in the after effects of a broken generation to see such promise die right before their eyes.
Absolutely.
And because we're now almost three generations post King's assassination, we have generations of people who lost not only faith in social progress, they lost faith in political progress.
That's right. Yep.
They lost faith also in the progress that can take place via the church in terms of societal progress and political progress. And I think that's one of the movements we have to try to gain back to. Because again, like the civil rights movement was a question of, will you actually meet the moral challenge of the day? It wasn't just about getting the right to vote.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the Civil Rights Act. It wasn't just about, you know, job equality. It was, we have to get these things by holding people morally
accountable. That's right.
That's how we have to continue the civil rights movement.
No, it's, you know, you something you said, a lot of things that you said really, really resonated. But I think one of the things was like that Dr. King, when he was assassinated, so many of us Black people are stuck at his assassination. Yeah. And it's almost like right at the point of the civil rights movement and when his assassination happened, it's like that movement died. People's spirits were broken. And I have never seen another leader after that, at least not visibly, right? We have like the Emmanuel Blanders out there and stuff. But, you know, that leader on the forefront, at the front lines, willing to risk it all, willing to challenge people at the level of their morality. It's like these are the types of things that we're missing. And so when you talk about like even the political, how we have not progressed even in the realm of politics, that's another huge arena.
Yeah.
You know, if you talk about education, politics and education, you know it so well, what's going on in New York City with the education budget cuts that are happening right before our eyes with this administration. I mean, when we talk about like the political progress, education and politics go hand in hand, but we're not seeing that. And we're also seeing, in my opinion, is also a disconnection between the church and the political sort of activity and involvement.
You know, it's, well, that's a whole podcast unto itself.
It sure is.
Well, okay, I'll dare everyone who's watching this to go to Google right now and Google, when did the civil rights movement end?
That's so good.
When you Google, when did the civil rights
movement end? Don't say on the day of Dr. King's assassination.
That's the exact date that it'll give you.
Are you kidding me?
Google will tell you that the civil rights movement ended the day that Dr. King was assassinated.
Wow.
And so when you talk about people feeling this sense of brokenness, and this is what a lot of people don't actually learn anymore in history classes.
Sure.
They don't talk about what happened in Newark. They don't talk about what happened in Harlem in terms of there being riots, actual riots in response to Dr. King being assassinated. The other thing that, you know, a lot of people will not talk about, and I would encourage you guys to check out Michael Eric Dyson, Professor Michael Eric Dyson's book, 1968, which is a brilliant work, where he talks about the power of education being the thing that can light fires. Dr. King was a revolutionary.
Yeah.
But this is Michael Eric Dyson's words that I'm quoting here. History has, and historical instruction has defanged him.
Wow.
Intentionally. When you go back into time and you actually take a look at his popularity, when you look at like how, I think they were doing polls, surveying how people felt about Dr. King, 1967, 1968, Dr. King was incredibly unpopular.
Wow.
There wasn't a song about him yet.
Right.
You know,
streets named after him.
There weren't streets named after him yet. There wasn't a holiday.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And the reason why is because the revolutionary, which he was, they have to point out the faults. They have to be the thing that says, no, I'm holding you accountable. And I think that when Dr. King was assassinated, a person who's holding groups, individuals, institutions, heads of government accountable and demanding more. See, a lot of us say stuck at I have a dream. But he, after the dream, he was like, okay, I'm coming here because there's a check. There's a promissory note. That's his language.
It's incredible.
And that he's coming and he's saying that it we are demanding this 5 years later. And I think this is part of where we have now had generations of people of color who were getting by. And increasingly, it's becoming more and more difficult to survive the same way we did 50 years ago. And that lack of feeling like we're making progress, it can anesthetize people. It can make people feel as if they're under anesthesia. And so I think this has been the post-civil rights struggle, is that there are those who may have lost hope. And it's been exacerbated by school systems that they stopped teaching. Once civil rights, they'll end with, I have a dream. And, you know, you go to Google and you'll see that, you know, Dr. King's assassinated in 68. And we even forget the correlation between the fact that he's killed because of institutional racism.
That's right.
Institutional racism doesn't die on April 4th, 1968.
That's right.
It leads to April 4th, 1968.
That's good. That, you know, that's so good. And I'm just wondering, like, what could we do? And I hate to say, I don't hate to say, like, revive the civil rights movement, but because I do believe that we're in a new era and there is a new era that needs to be created, or at least a new movement. I don't know what the spark is going to be. I thought we were there with George Floyd, but, you know, that went so many ways. But the thing that really stuck out to me, Emmanuel, what you were talking about, is the fact that Dr. King was a man of faith. Right. And then when I think about him, he was in the White House. He was negotiating deals and policies and laws with government officials. And so there was such a political involvement and engagement as a man of faith, as a pastor or reverend. Right. And so I wonder, you being a senior pastor, how do we get the senior pastors to recognize that this is also a kingdom responsibility?
I think part of what has to happen is, with all due respect, I think that sometimes we have to be prophetic. And now I'm speaking to senior pastors. I'm speaking to pastors, bishops, elders, deacons, whomever. We have to be prophetic, and we can't be idolaters.
That's good.
Many of us idolize the Black church experience, and we've forgotten the purpose of the Black church experience. To be prophetic in this moment means that you should continue the struggle. That just didn't start in 68 or 63. It just didn't start, you know, for, you know, post-Civil War. This has been, you know, the people of color experience. Since the dawn of, you know, crossing over in terms of the Middle Passage. And so I think for some, there is this unwillingness to be a revolutionary for fear of what the personal repercussions or what the personal costs might be. But God chooses people that he wants to place in uncomfortable positions. I can't think of a biblical hero who wasn't placed in an uncomfortable position. You know, whether it's Abraham going somewhere he doesn't know. Whether it's David, you know, this adolescent facing a giant, you know, from Moses having to deal with people who were so difficult. And also born, I mean, literally born in a position of discomfort. You know, so I think that's one of the things that unfortunately we don't talk enough about in the Black church experience, is that we were born to be in uncomfortable positions. And it's not just for our own personal gain, but there's a greater good that we are also responsible for.
That's so good. It's so good. And I wish we could stay here for like three hours and talk about this. But I have one last question, and I'm wondering, you know, what would it look like if the church ministry, ministerial leaders, you know, if they actually took their place, essentially, in this arena of education. How would it look different to you? How would it transform structures, curricula, lives of children and families in the next 10 to 20 years?
I think part of it is, what would it look like? It would look like mentorship, for example.
Yeah.
You know, right now there's a teacher crisis. Absolutely. Where teachers are leaving the professions. Some of the statistics say that there are fewer teachers entering into the ranks of the profession, mm-hmm. more than ever. There's not just a teacher crisis, though. I think that's, like, on the surface, one of the problems.
Sure.
There's a mentor problem. Mm. There's more and more of a chasm. There's more of a divide between what happens in the school building and what happens in the community. You know, there are very few community leaders. There are very few people who participate and say, I'm going to extend what takes place in the school building outside of the school building.
Yeah.
And the more the church breaks down, the more fewer people attend the church, the more there's less of a community center.
Sure.
Because really, that's also what the church has historically been. Mm. It's been a community center.
Right.
And one of the things we talk about in terms of, like, the effects of the pandemic is that there's a growing sense of isolation.
Yeah.
There's a growing sense of anxiety. There's a growing sense of people feeling alone and desperate and higher rates of depression.
Yeah.
Well, part of what alleviates those things is a sense of community.
Community.
But
absolutely,
the fewer opportunities that we have to actually interact as community, mm-hmm. The harder it becomes for the church to be a change agent. And so what does it look like for senior pastors or administrators or bishops to be at the heart of education?
Yeah.
It's about being one, willing to be a revolutionary.
Yeah.
Two, accepting that schools can't do everything.
That's right.
You know, and I think that's one of the misconceptions that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the things that in the public debate that's unrealistic. A lot of times we expect schools to do everything.
Absolutely not.
They can't.
Right.
They can't. And I think that that's one of the things that I try to preach in terms of, like, what can churches do to be revolutionary, mm-hmm. and practical and pragmatic, and here's the key word, relevant.
Yes.
Identify what schools can't do.
Yeah.
Invest in those things and start to create those programs that schools just can't do by themselves. You know your members better than the school does.
And you have the trust and the faith.
Yes.
Of your members.
Yes.
That's so good. And lastly, I know we talked about this in a previous talk. It was something around having a school inside of a church, or
absolutely.
I don't know if a ministry in a church, or if it was a flip, but what would that look like for you, this vision that you had talked to me about previously?
This is actually something that I'm developing and working on as we speak.
Sure.
Is, you know, I wholeheartedly believe, and having been an educator for such a long time,
mm-hmm.
and having taught, you know, secondary, you know, all the way up to the graduate school level, I, like what I just said before, I understand what schools can do. I can understand what schools can't do. They have practical limitations. Yeah. We only have kids for 6 hours,
right.
6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
And they have to take state mandated courses, and there's gym, and they have to have lunch. But I also know, for example, there's the practical reality of many states have limits in terms of how many days we see kids.
Yeah.
So if you only see kids 170 days mm-hmm. to 190 days,
mm-hmm.
there's but so much history you can teach that kid. But that also means that teachers will make choices.
Mm-hmm.
What history gets taught?
Yeah.
What history does not get taught?
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we teach what we know, or we teach what we're comfortable with.
Yeah.
So for me, I already know that the history of people of color
mm-hmm.
disappears.
Mm.
So what does that look like in a church?
Yeah.
Why aren't there courses that we're offering in our churches
mm-hmm.
to pick up the slack?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are talking about financial literacy courses. They should be in schools.
Yeah.
Well, here's the problem. If states are cutting funding for schools,
mm-hmm.
particularly certain schools that we all know.
Absolutely.
Where do you think those kids are going to actually learn the financial literacy skills that they need?
Right.
And that's what I mean about the cyclical nature of generational poverty.
Sure.
There are times in which churches can actually be at the front lines.
Right.
And there are churches doing this. There are churches. I know that there are churches. There are organizations that are doing this, mm-hmm. but more of us need to do it.
Yeah.
Because I really believe that the idea of us being and building the kingdom of God is that we actually have to be in the work of actually doing it.
That's right.
So
in the community.
In the community. And that's what I meant about being a community center. You should be at the center of your community.
You know, that's so, it's so good. And we don't have time, but I'm thinking of so many other things about Jesus being the center and the center of community, talking constantly, whether it be people in a temple or Pharisees or scribes or having these conversations and really shifting paradigms.
Absolutely.
But he couldn't do that from the temple. He had to go into the community to confront and to create new structures.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, I love this idea, and I would love to know in the future more about like how that project that you're working on is evolving.
I would love to come back and share it with you and to partner with people. And I think that's the part too. It's like to learn how to partner with different groups, different organizations, different places.
Yeah. Partnership is important. Absolutely. We cannot do it by ourselves. And, you know, we got to get out of this competitive thing where it's like, I can't partner with this church because they're not my church. Yeah. Or I don't want to partner with this agency. There is no way. We definitely have to find ways to collaborate, combine, join forces to do this work.
Amen.
Yeah.
Love it.
Well, it was such a pleasure, Emmanuel. How can people reach out to you, follow you, if they want to get in contact? I didn't know if you were doing the consultant work yet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely doing the consulting work.
Excellent. Yes. Tell us more about that and how can people find you.
In terms of my consulting work, one of the things that I do is I love to partner either with schools or with faith communities in terms of how they can create more dynamic learning experiences for the people that they serve. So whether it's about creating more diverse curriculum, for example, how do you include more people of color in your content? That is so important. I can't tell you how many times kids feel as if they're not seen in their classes and they have no vested interest. And so that's one of the key ways in which we create a school to prison pipeline. Tell a kid they're so unimportant by not showing them people that look like them. Wow. So you can find me on all of my socials at EJ_Blanchard, which is BLANCHARD, EJ_Blanchard. So best way to find me, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. And I would love to partner with you. So you can DM me, you can send me an email, and we can actually create projects that are manageable. And that's the other thing that I like to stress, are practical, easy ways where you can get more buy-in. Because a lot of times, like, you can see one thing that's working for one organization, one school, one church, and you're like, but I have 12 members, I have 15 members, it's not gonna work for me. There's always a practical solution. And that's one of the things that I try to do, is work in real practical manners.
That's incredible. And just last question, are you also, is this open to pastors?
Absolutely,
that may want your service?
You know, one of the things that I've been blessed to do is to work with young people for the majority of my career. So not just in pastoring, but also in terms of education. So, you know, that has been my life. Learning how to, and I think that's another problem that a lot of pastors have, is that they like to kind of push young people, sequester them.
Right.
They're like, okay, go to the basement or go to the auxiliary room. Like,
maybe
I don't want to
started on that one.
You know, I'm afraid. I don't know what you listen to. I don't know what's happening.
Right.
You know, fortunately, that is not me. That's not my vibe. Like, you know, although I'm a senior pastor, I also love working with young people. I also love working with teens. That has been the fulcrum. That's been at the heart of my career. So, yes, if you would like to discuss this further, I would love to partner with you as well, too.
That's so incredible. Well, thank you for all that you do, for your place in this world, and for being the architect that you are in education. You're needed. So I appreciate you, and I hope that in the future you consider coming to Atlanta to help the schools out here, too, because we definitely need an Emmanuel Blanchard out here.
I would love to. I would love to. So, yes, absolutely. I will definitely come through again. Thank you.
Well, guys, it's been such a pleasure having Emmanuel here. If this message inspired you, and we know that it has, I want you to do us a favor and share it out to your networks, your colleagues, or to an educator that we know will be inspired by this episode. Emmanuel, thank you again for joining me. It's been a pleasure. We love you all. We appreciate you all. Stay tuned for next week's episode.